Good evening. It's great to see a packed house, which is no less than Daniel Leverskin deserves. This is the fourth lecture in the series sponsored by the Royal Academy of Arts and the LSE Cities Programme. There are two more lectures in the series. On March the 15th, Norman Foster, and on the 24th of May, Charles Correia. Tonight we have Daniel Leverskin. He once told me that he thought he was a very traditional architect, which I think was a bit of a surprise for the good citizens of the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, who regard his spiral as anything but traditional. However, by that he meant that, I think, that like architects of the past, he was concerned not only with sort of technological performance of a building, but also the sort of cultural and social role of a building within the city. If he is a traditional architect, he's an unusual architect. He's had an extraordinary life living in many countries: Poland, Britain, Israel, America, Germany. He was a musician before he was an architect, and he was a theoretical architect before he was a practicing architect. And his first job was the Jewish Museum in Berlin, by which he neatly jumped over the usual sort of apprenticeship of extensions and cafes that other architects go through. Since then, he's become very busy doing projects all over the world. In Britain, his Imperial War Museum in Salford is under construction.
Trafford.
Excuse my ignorance of Lancashire geography. He's the architect, of course, of the spiral of the V&A, which we have high hopes will be built, depending on who the director of that institution turns out to be. He's working on the Jewish Museum in San Francisco and many other projects. I'd also say the other respect in which he's an unusual architect is that he has a brain. He has a sort of intellectual brain, whereas a lot of architects are very good with their hands but aren't so interesting when they speak. So in order to prove the point, I'll now hand over to Danny.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ron. I'm delighted to be here, particularly because many people in this audience are studying social sciences and planning and are interested in urbanism and cities. And I have to admit to you that I hesitated entering into architecture for one particular reason. And I have not been in practice for a long time. I know how much humanity, social space, social justice have to do with architecture. But I also know, as everyone else, that architecture is produced in conditions of capital. You have to have money in order to build things. And the transformation of culture through capital is something which architecture deals but with difficulty, because it is difficult to transform political power, economic power, and of course we live in a time when the market power is so overwhelming that we often forget that cities are not made from media, they are not made from concrete and steel and glass and economic forces, they are made from citizens. And by the way, that's not Karl Marx, that's St. Augustine. So the important thing, how to engage humanity, how to engage people in the problem of creating and making cities, and of course that's not a theoretical problem. It's not a problem that can be solved by computing. It's not a problem that can be cybernetically or vicariously experienced. It's a problem that has to be engaged in the practice of materiality, which is of course the very essence of capital. So really that paradox and that beauty of that paradox is really my own interest in urbanism, and I have proposed very different methods in dealing with construction of master plans in cities. I would like to begin by showing a project which I call Potsdamer Plots. It's my sort of long-range strategy. I did not win the competition for Potsdamer Plots. It's been built, it's economically successful, but I think it is culturally a poor representation of the aspirations of Germany, of people that I know who live in the city, that I've been able to get to know. So if I might turn the projector and turn down the lights, please. Is it possible to turn off the lights? And yes. I think that a city, now I've often thought, what is its definition? But one of its definition must relate to a thought of Bergson, which is that a city is also a mechanism for production, not only of ideology, but of gods themselves. Because cities are ultimately emblems of those aspirations which are not really only visible, but of course, enter dimensions of the mind, of the imagination, what we call the spirit of culture. And I studied Berlin in terms of this mechanism, which is continually producing and reproducing itself in the form of power that the master plan represents. Now, I attempted to do in my project, which, by the way, I was successful subsequently in the Landsberg Allee, where I won a major competition for the former Lenin Allee to reconstruct a huge part of the city using this strategy, which is not to do a master plan. Of course, we need master plans, because master plans are what permits us to build logically and coherently in time. But to create a master plan without mastery, to create a master plan without mastery in the sense of temporal domination, that old picture of architect as the god with those, as he's represented in those incredible diagrams in medieval times, architect is not God. Architect is not a powerful being. The architect gives shape to forces which are social. He's not, and or she's not, really the crown of the tree, but only the conduit, the trunk, transmitting that rooted power of human beings into environments which are decent, just, and beautiful. So that matrix, that muse matrix, which I drew here, represents a city which is not really visible along its coordinate points. It's not really a city of grids and extensions of grids and a kind of Cartesian notion that controlled neutral space is the context of human imagination. But it is really those vectors that entwine us into a variety of musical lines. And I say musical lines because the muses are fully musical, whether they are tragic or comic or lyric or represent the dance. I think Shakespeare was right when he said, the man who has no music, da-da-da-da, will ultimately commit a crime, will murder, will do something of that sort. And what did he mean by that? Well, he meant exactly that a city is a communication. And I did send out a message to all my friends, you know, Wim Wenders, Dalai Lama, the Pope, everybody who could respond to me, and I did. William Gibson, whose works I love, gave me a number. Jacques Derrida wrote a, and I asked them to give me a point and a place in time where one could really hinge, so to speak, that grid of the city against human aspiration. And I got various responses. If you could focus that. I don't know whether you can read that. It's translated here into French, sort of, yes? That's, yes? Is it? Oh, yes, yes. There is a diagram of Berlin drawn by a thinker, philosopher, writer, who thinks that Berlin is about a chiasm of directions that have to do with dates, not at all even with names. And he moves it around the Soviet-German relationship. It's extremely interesting, very brief reply, a little bit longer than William Gibson. In the reply of Paul Virilio, whose works you might know, he gave me a kind of a three-dimensional set of dates. Yes, keep going. It's interesting, but it's too blurred. Yeah, do it slowly. In any case, you perhaps get the idea that by consultation of citizens, and I didn't only consult my friends, I consulted people who were passing by where I was working. I consulted names which are hardly visible on this public record, and maybe it's appropriate that my friend Heiner Müller, whose plays you probably know, The Hamlet Machine, did give me a mathematical figure and a place which, as obscure as it is, was part of my idea of how to take that homogeneity. And I think that the city is always threatened by a homogeneity of power. whether it's through media, political control, or capital, that homogeneity which reduces the fragments of significance into one uniform space, instead of the plurality, which is actually represented by the differences carried by people, by their own notions of life, and by their own invisible cities. And I think that's really the strategy here, how to transform that huge, abstract, homogeneous space we call urban space into a particular space which carries not only the pragmatic meanings of its own configurations, but is at the same time something that speaks to others, can be constructed, and can also be developed in time. I think that's a very important point that, and what I said about master planning might not sound very legible to you, but really master plans are about fixing things into a frame, freezing them for a future which is never there. And my notion here is that you can, through very clear methods, through very clear criteria, create a city where the differences, the future possibilities, the flexibility of an open future is actually inscribed into a plan which is really not dealing simply with alignments of walls and windows, but has to do with the cultural impetus of development, which certainly has to do with, finally, with windows, walls, and doorways. I hope that we can see some clarity here. There are fragments here. These happen to be fragments of Potsdamer plots, fragments which have been taken to mean something very particular, which do mean something as places, as moments of time, as memory. And think of it, I think without memory, there would be no city, there would be no urban space. Memory, which seems the most abstract of all elements when we speak about it this way, is really what ties it all together. If you enter a room and see an old man sitting on a chair with a bookcase behind him and a canary singing in a birdcage, and you don't have a memory, you realize that it's just a piece of madness. It's a theater of the absurd. It's only the memory that can give us a connection between events that returns them away from that metaphysical space into a person's life. So fragments, and these are various fragments. I created a number of fragments, actually 10 fragments, 9 plus 1, the 9 muses, plus the one which was not in the matrix of the Greeks. I added one muse, the 10th one, which was the muse of money. Because certainly that is a musical relationship, and money is not to be treated as something which is only external to architecture. It is part of that locus. I'm sorry if all the slides are going to be out of focus. This is horrible for you. It's horrible for me. There is a focus here as well. Sometimes you don't know that the most important things are very small. Here are these fragments, and these are fragments of actual space. These are not abstractions, these are not actual objects of art, but they're actually three-dimensional spatial constructions, which of course have not been cut out of the plan of Berlin, but created by those matrix lines, which have defined certain notions around a hospital, around a tavern, around a school, around a cemetery, places which a labyrinth of the city would reveal as ultimately significant, as we know from our own experience and from the world we live in. So the point is that these fragments come back into a whole which is really aligned with the history of the city, but at the same time different, at the same time taking on a new configuration, a new capacity. And I think these fragments, and if you think of this underground subway systems of cities, the things which are below the visible, not only spatially, but also psychologically, socially, that is really that strategy for dealing with a city like with a human being. Really, it's not just an anthropomorphism, but the fact that cities have a logic. They have minds, but they also have bodies. They also have the subconscious. They have the physiognomy of space, which cannot really be manipulated only by the physiology, I would say, or statistical manipulations of the abstract notion of the city, which reveals itself only, I think, between 9 to 5. After 5 o'clock and before 9 o'clock, the city is completely different. Even though we studied with daylight, it is really not to be etherealized on an operating table, but to be seen as a constructions of desire, construction of beauty, construction which reveals something to us which we don't know, and ultimately is, I think, exactly that machine for producing God or gods, because really the cities are in process. They are not really icons only. They are not only really empty-headed gods or gods deprived of their former historicity, but are actually in development. And we don't know that the city will not change suddenly. By the way, that's interesting from a historical point of view, that cities don't change gradually. They change suddenly. And in all my studies, I've been fascinated with that moment where suddenly something that was horribly evil turns to be a prototype of good, or something which was meant to be never is, and vice versa. Think of such a banal example as the Colosseum, a machine for killing people. That machine should become the model of the most beautiful kind of arcades and stairways to bring mass of humanity into upper levels is itself part of that divinity, I would say, which has always been associated with any act that has to do with cutting the soil, giving a templum of space, and creating something that we would call contemporary. But I do think of it very often, and you might also, that what Roman didn't think that Rome would be there forever? I mean, as they looked from the walls of the Colosseum across the Forum, they must have thought that this was eternal. The same as those people living in medieval castles in Europe. Didn't they think? They built them for eternity. They built them in that landscape to last. And isn't that true for inhabitants of Chicago, New York, London? They look out of those windows and are confident that life will always, but life does continue, often in ways which create densities, which create relationships, which open up a thoroughly new discourse, a thoroughly new relationship to people, and revive our own timeless, I would say, cross-section, because in a way we are involved in the timeless when we are involved in the city. We have only a cross-section of that eternity, which of course is there as the ultimate post-mortem judgment of a city. And I've been always fascinated that in all those depictions of the city, it's shown like that. Now, I demonstrate that buildings too have that capacity, and I designed the Jewish Museum not just to fit into a city, but to transform the city with the light of a star, which is no longer really there in that way, inscribed as it is into the East and West, connecting and marrying the city back through documents that are not really purely architectural. This slide is reversed, but you can see that yellow-covered Schoenberg score, which for Moses and Aaron, which I transcribed into the Between the Lines text, or you can see here the Gedenkbuch itself, the 6 million Gedenkbuch, which is itself already that unspeakable, unplayable score, which always controls now the destiny of a city in its memory, because that is what Berlin is about. And it is, of course, about the name Berlin also. The name Berlin is not just standing for the general name Berlin that you see on signs to roads and airports, but it is the Berlin, the name Berlin, taken on by others whose name was not Berlin, particularly Jews, who called themselves Berlin Berliner when they came there, given the full rights during the Enlightenment. So it's about people and that connection. And of course, ultimately, the building stands there as a manifestation of foundations, of walls, of steel, whatever it is. But actually, it speaks to the city. It's a fragment of a city because it's not very big. And yet, it is also responsible in that fragmentary notion of transformation, heterogeneity, plurality, to contribute something else to that world. And that world, which I explored in the City Edge project, by trying to remake the globe. And sure, it's a problem of architecture, it's projection, because the globe has fallen apart. It's one of my projects where the globe has fallen apart, has become flattened, has become different. And I used this thought in the Imperial War Museum, because what is conflict but the really breaking of the crust, the thin crust of the earth, into shards which never come back again in the same sense of globality as a graphic element on CNN News, but the tension which inscribes the longing for a world that makes sense and yet confronts us with the fact that conflict, as it is here shown in those huge forms of spaces of the museum. These are, by the way, notions that don't relate only to museums. They relate to any program. But in this case, the air, the earth, water, the fire of space and exhibits and tragedy is actually speaking out. And how interesting, along the old ship canal, the building opens itself and shows its thinness, its convex, concave, its vulnerability also in the sky, but also reorients and gives a completely new meaning to an urban area. And I think that's very important, that buildings not just fit into context, because that would be the end of the city, but that they also take up the challenge to contribute something back into that context. You can't just take money out of a bank all the time, because then the bank, there'll be no money. You have to put something back into the savings account, so to speak, in order to be able to draw from the legacy. And I think really that is the point of doing architecture and being interested in urbanism. Now, I was lucky just a few days ago or a few weeks ago to win a competition for really the largest project I ever was confronted with, which is in Switzerland, Brunnen, right at the entrance to the capital of Switzerland, for what, 250,000 square meters of space. Now think of it, 250,000, that's a city. It's a diverse program of housing, of hotels, of shopping centers, of leisure, of all the economic everyday things that go. It's a regional economic scheme. And there were many architects in the competition. I have to say what I did, which the others did not do. And they were good friends of mine, good architects, Jean Nouvel, Fuchs, lots of interesting ideas. I refused to do this idea as a master plan, because what good is a master plan with plug-in units of banal architecture? It should be conceived as a city, physiognomically built as a set of buildings, and not just as an abstract matrix to be plugged in by commercial interests. So I proposed on this highway to create something which would not just be abstract. Now, I got myself into trouble, because originally they thought, either we will do a master plan, and then we'll invite 10 architects to do the different buildings, or we'll choose one scheme where the architect will be responsible for everything. So now I've got a challenge, because I've got to construct this 250,000 square meters of space myself. I don't need to do it myself, because I've got Nina here. But the point is that it will be a true challenge, and I just run through a kind of what it is, because it's on a highway. It's not a suburb. It's not nowhere. It's the gateway. It's a regional center. It's just within the horizon of the medieval quarter of Bern. And it has this musical relationship, kind of a tension between the vectors of travel, of escape, of communication, of the car, of trains, which is being a train station line is being constructed. How does one make something which is humane, which is not just a shopping center or a leisure center out of context, but it relates itself to nature, relates itself to the desires of the investors. And by the way, what was interesting for me is I worked very closely, three-stage competition, responding to the people who will actually occupy and who will build it. Migros, the largest company in Switzerland, is in charge of it, to learn from them what is it that they really want. They don't want really people just to shop. What a banal idea that shopping centers are for shopping. I immediately got to this point. I said, look, I hate shopping because it's boring. I do like to buy once in a while something, but I don't like shopping centers. They said, look, Mr. Linsky, design anything but a shopping center, because we also don't like shopping centers. So there is an agreement, even across that wide divide. And I just show you that from that topographical beauty of connections of the landscape, through a strategy of how to put complex programming within this sort of musical body, and how to make it emerge without just manipulating data to a building that can, or set of buildings, or many buildings. There's a computer, not a design, but a generated image of it. You can see at least its scale here, and you can see the complexity, because of course there are clients who have already all their given programs, the Baumarkt, IKEA, all those companies which already have bought space. But I just show you that I developed it as a city, not as a place in the country, as a kind of hybrid possibility of a city within a city, or with a city which is altering the balance of the city of Bern and Zurich and Basel. It's all within just minutes, within communication networks, and creating a place which suddenly opens out to perspectives that are not really ones which are solitary. They don't create an illusionistic idea of place, but do speak also of the Corbusian towers, which stand right next to it, to the empty factories of Toblerone company, which are on the site, and to the future developments, which will certainly have to have something to do with the site and with the topography and with the commerce and finally cultural aspiration of this area. So there it is. And I end very briefly, because I'm reaching a lot of time, with a project that has been not always easy, but always fascinating, the Victoria Albert Museum. I started a while ago when I won the competition, but you know, it has to develop such a project, you know, because it's not easy to get planning permissions. It's not easy to convince people that history is not a mimicry. It's not about nostalgia. It's not about repetition of just images, but that, in case you don't even know, repetition is not possible, because repetition is in time. It's not even possible to repeat anything convincingly. So how to do a building which is not really about itself, but it's about that incredible, by the way, radical socialist idea of planning and of theory, because William Morris and Henry Cole were no amateurs to the notion of how public realm develops. And unashamedly created a manifesto in the way they designed the area to create a place where the public is not underestimated, where the public is inspired, where the public is considered the goal and not only the means to realizing a city plan. So the towers, and I often show this because it's lost, but it's not. You know, the spiral is here. It's part of a great composition, and the context of it is much more fascinating than we know, because we seldom get a key into it. And the idea for the V&A is a very simple one. It's to give a completely new key. It's not just to clean the galleries and to sweep the dirt and to make everything better, but to give a new orientation, which would take the geometry of Owen Jones, the social notions of William Morris, Henry Cole's notion that people should also eat in a place, workers should be given rights, just like rich people, that this has to be brought up to date today across the transformations of society. So yes, it is a spiral. It didn't begin as an icon just for the sake of, but the spiraling movement of art, of activity, which really rises itself through its own tectonic quality. And what is the tectonic quality of any building? It's walls. It's the fact that it has to stand up. So that spiral is, of course, what the museum really is. It's about continuity of walls, floors, ceilings, openings, which give possibility to new exhibition concepts and to new involvement of the public in restaurants and shops and so on. So if you were to unfold that world of the highest achievements, which William Morris considered to be the spiral spiral itself, you would get that realm of linearity, which of course is what architects deal with, because they have to, but if you were to fold it back on itself to maximize the surface, any child could create this this spiral. And the middle one is actually a structural model which shows stresses on the walls. It's not just a pretty picture, but it is about evocative communication, because the buildings are not just anonymous and transcendent beings. They are part of the program. And you can see here the program is complex. It has mezzanine, it has public places, it has restaurants, which at all points give access to the nexus of connections, which is the V&A itself. And the V&A is not just the buildings. It's a bigger idea then. It's a bigger spiritual idea, because as you well know, no one actually knows, and I'm involved in about 6 or 7 museums. I asked the experts, does anybody know what goes on in the head of a person in a museum? Nobody could tell me, because people go to museums, but their heads are not locked in the museum. Their heads are exploded to that musical connection, which is about everything. And whether it's a museum, shopping center, or whatever it might be, it is part of that human world. So there is a floor plate which shows the heterogeneous spatiality of it. It's not just a box. It contains theaters, demonstration spaces, places where people can contemplate, education spaces, giving also access along this centripetal movement of the form to different buildings built at different times by different architects over, what, a period of a century. And I think this will really not just reinvigorate that incredible institution, but give it a light, give it a lightness, give it a sense of perspective that people really want, desire, need, because it's about the creative process. It's not just about creating objects. And that process doesn't end with things. It ends with the life those things take in the mind of the citizen and in the mind of the city. So you see it here in model form with its fractal facade, and what I don't have time to go into it, but so interesting that I discovered with Cecil Baumann, who's my engineer and creative collaborator, that in fact all these chaotic series of mathematical fractals, which we now use in cosmology and modern physics, finally are underpinned by the Fibonacci series, the golden section, the most treasured classical things, which are only the beginning of the process of development, which is contemporary as well. So I think you can get something of the scale. It's a building that turns, that struggles to bring the desired experience to the programs of the museum and to the public at large. This is at the very head of the building, where we have the restaurants, and also, by the way, spectacular views, not for the sake of panoramic pleasures, but also because it's, I think, the best way for people to get to know the V&A is just to look down and see that those rooftops are not just secular, banal, technological wonderments, but are actually spiritually conceived by the architect as being essentially crafted to be artworks. And I think that, yes, that is my intention, to craft, handcraft the building, and I believe in it. I do believe in the handcraft, not only because I'm doing the V&A, I believed it from the very beginning, that you have to make the thing, because ultimately, ideas are not communicated in words in architecture. They are communicated by someone opening a door, looking out of a window, going to an elevator, taking a stair. Those things and their echoes and their atmosphere has to be the one which is poetically inspiring and poetically beautiful. And I think that is the contribution to a city. That is really what makes a city like London so fantastic, because it has that layering. And I think it needs more than just buildings behind old walls. It needs that vitality, which is so fantastic, also to be given to the street face of a building, not just inside old buildings, not behind walls, not in an embarrassed way, but as a pride, because this city and its citizens who have worked on this building deserve the very best. And I end really here, because my 32.3 minutes are over, that really the program doesn't come from anywhere, but it has been inscribed by those great Victorians, which I really love, because they never were metaphorical. They were not interested in metaphors, but they were interested in metamorphosis. And there it is, inspiration and knowledge, the two figures so poetically and prophetically placed at the left and right side of the entrance to the Victoria and Albert Museum. I think that's really the memory, and that is also the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. I think you got more into 32.3 minutes than most people get into a week of talking. I think the audience might like to ponder on some of those things and then possibly think of some questions to ask shortly. While you're thinking of that, I'd like to ask Danny something, which is, in his work so far, there's a really extreme contrast, opposition between his building and what else happens around, particularly what else is happening in contemporary architecture. This is very obvious in Berlin, where you have the Potsdamer Platz that's actually built, various other developments which are of a rather kind of normalizing, bland kind. And the Jewish Museum is very, very striking for being completely different from anything else that's happening. So what I want to ask is, to what extent your thinking can extend beyond the individual building as a sort of magical object and really inform the way roads are built and streets are furnished and so on?
It's a good question. I didn't have time really in this short talk to really go into it, but I could show you my scheme, which, as I said, I won the first prize in Berlin for the Landsberg Allee competition. It's a huge area, bigger, about twice as large or three times as large as Potsdamer Platz, which is being implemented very, very slowly. There's not a lot of investment in the East. This is near Poland. I mean, it's towards Poland. It's going to take a long time. But I did propose exactly that. Streets, utility lines, how to deal with disused factories, which are not going to come back as factories, with housing blocks, which are there where hundreds of thousands of people live today. This is near Marzahn in the East.
and how to do it in a way which is not about really graphic elements of the plan, but where the plans, which of course are ultimately graphic and conceptual and statistical, give a direction of spatiality and organization to the city. I struggled. It was not an easy thing because, of course, at the end you have to produce a master plan, which is a drawing with a complete continuity of streets and so on. But, another project in which actually is going to be discussed with very distinguished people in March with Gerhard Schroeder and James Young and a number of important politicians in Germany, project which I proposed for Oranienburg on the former SS lands of Sachsenhausen, which of course extend beyond the memorial, a huge black hole in the city. I didn't win that competition. I was disqualified, by the way, 7 years ago. Because I didn't do what the politicians wrote in the program, which is to build a new city there. I said, yes, I can understand you have to build a new city in this area because that's the only resource, the land and people. But you have to also deal with history, and you cannot reduce Germany to just a gigantic memorial. You have to deal with it in the future. And I did propose something very radical, which is how to deal with Sachsenhausen. How to do something, and not to develop it, not to create shopping centers, but to develop it in as a sense of the city. It's right in the middle of a growing city. And it's been 7 years. Though I was disqualified, the citizens of Oranienburg, former East Germany, liked it. They rejected the idea that they should build a whole city. They understood that there was something on the land, there was something in the trees, in the sky, and in the future of the economy of the city, which needed to be molded in a different way. And I think, this is a planning project, a large planning project, which I believe is also a paradigm for how to deal with other problems. It's not only, of course, disused old historical lands, but there are disused lands in England. And I was, I did try in Allerton Bywater. I know Richard Rogers is here, my good friend. I didn't win this competition, but I proposed a master plan which maybe didn't look like axial development of rigorous notions of order, but I believe that order has to be transformed. We don't need the kind of order that we've been given in the 19th century, 1870. We don't need the authoritarian idea of order. We need a different kind of order. So I'm not really responding specifically. I have to go in depth to the plans. Otherwise, it's very difficult to demonstrate, but I guarantee that it's a public process. None of these projects have been designed without a huge public process where I had to present it to the citizens, in Oranienburg only citizens, some of them living in the former SS houses, which occupied the vast area around the and it is they who actually have to make the project. It's not really the architects, I think, who simply design some nice things which are then abandoned and so on.
Okay, well, if anyone would like to ask a question, we would welcome it.
Somebody in the front here.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the project in Bern, I haven't seen any housing development, so I wonder where the people live. Could you talk about a city?
You saw on the plan, on the site plan on the right, a kind of schematic size of a city. You saw a kind of grid? Well, that is the projected city of thousands of people. It's not yet, of course, designed. It's only a schematic representation of the number of houses and their heights, which will be on the site. The project will develop. It's the shopping centers and the commercial aspect is on the highway. The city which is developing is immediately to the south of it. So you saw it on the plan as a schematic, a kind of grillage. But it will develop. And of course, my own proposition was to put particularly the elderly people housing and the young people's housing onto the piazza, which is where the new railway station is being constructed. So I guarantee there is a huge component of housing. It's not going to be the first one to be developed. It's the last one. They will first develop the shopping, first develop the hotels and the leisure center, and slowly develop the housing component, which of course is being integrated. I have to tell you this, what you saw was only half of the shop. That's 250,000 square meters. It's only half of what they hope this shopping district, this city called Nexus or Brunnen will be in 10 years. This is a 5-year plan.
I'm intrigued with that project, with how you're going to, what happens when your architecture meets the architecture of the outlets within the shopping mall, when you have a Starbucks and a McDonald's or whatever with their own kind of in-house architecture that's the opposite of yours. What happens then?
Well, I think I'm very happy with Starbucks and all those things. I have no problem. I think the importance here is to design the public space, and I think that's really the role of architecture. It's the public space. It's not the private spaces of companies, whatever. It's what that experience for a person walking the, you know, in the 19th century, that the flaneur, remember that beautiful Baudelaire idea that at the end of Western civilization, somebody walks to see it all and to account of all of it somehow as a flower of possibility. And by the way, Baudelaire is a very good example, and you are a social scientist, a lot of you, so I hope you read Baudelaire, because in his book, he's got a very interesting statement. He said, there are two ways to improve humanity. One is to take opium. And the other one is to read Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Social Contract. He says, the goal is the same, but you can take two roads to it. And of course, he chose Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Oh, he wrote a book on opium. But anyway, I do believe that architecture deals with a social contract. So it is design of the public spaces, the streets, what you see, the kind of dignified relationship also between nature and the place. And I think what is very unusual in the scheme, and probably you don't see it here, is that the landscape of this part, which is, I think, stunning, is actually going into this form of circulation of the public. It's not, and I had to argue against making a shopping center like, what is it called, Whitewater here?
Bluewater, sorry.
Whitewater, something else. Bluewater, which is about closing the horizon and making people lose the orientation to where they are, forget where they are, enter a dream world. I think people should not really enter the dream, because the world is already a dream, so really connect it.
You said so many things so rapidly and so quickly, many exciting things you were saying. Still trying to catch some of the ideas. Many of these ideas seem to me to be metaphorical lift-off points for your projects and not to be taken literally. For instance, when you speak of the music of the lines in these various projects, do you mean that literally or metaphorically as an inspirational point? Secondly, when you talk about the V&A, when you were speaking of fractals, you said that fractals being used in the new cosmologies. Well, is that true? I mean, in the new cosmologies, they're certainly using a whole series of different geometries, but they're not really using fractals, are they?
Fractals.
They're not really using them, are they?
They are. It's a Mandelbrot set. Of course it is. It's one of them. Of course, the world is more than just one thing.
But not for cosmology. Certainly for land-based, earth-based geometries, yes, but not for cosmology. But secondly, is the V&A literally, is it a true fractal?
Okay, you ask many questions also, very quickly. It's very difficult to answer all of them, but I'll try. I'll go with your first question about metaphor. No, I don't see these things as metaphors. But as real things, the time inscribed by a citizen of a time and place, I took as a point of literal departure, not a metaphorical departure. That date around which I designed a number of structures, because it's also about time. It's not just about what we see today. It's about what was there in the plan of the city many years ago, and layers and layers and layers. Those layers don't really go away. They can be hidden and covered. But I used the music. Where is the music? What is music? I used it literally, but not as a musical notational system, because of course, as an architect, I know that the relationship between music and architecture is, of course, geometric. We know that from the time of Pythagoras, which we must remember was not a very rational man, a mystic with a tiny little sect organized around 9 points. But in any case, the Pythagorean notion that lengths of strings and and geometric spaces were related. The notion of harmony of a city has to do with also what you built. I use literally because it is about geometric, spatial, measurable relationships. So yes, to go on to your question, if I can answer about the V&A, yes, the use of the fractals is actually part of the notion of how to structure the vast skin of the building, the body of those walls, in order to make them also respond in scale to the perspective. So some of the fractals are very, very large, appear as many meter high. Some of them are very, very small, which are really scaled to pedestrian on the street. I have to say that all of these ideas have to be examined in architecture from the point of view of a person walking, talking, speaking, sitting, doing something, or meditating. So it's hard to answer the abstract question in abstraction. I could really go into how that geometry is being used in the building and why. And if we had the time, shall I go on?
Yeah, why not?
So the skin is not conceived as a homogeneous plane, but as a coming together of components, three different figures, each one a right angle figure from the Amman non-repetitive series, constructively built out of three singular elements, which within themselves are sub-similarly divided, in order to give a completely new appearance to the walls that people will see, and they will see them also, of course, three-dimensionally, because the building leaves space between the Henry Cole, Western Range, and Web Wings, so that you can actually glance at the differences of architecture, which actually are now hidden from view. And the notion here is to create a building that shows the diversity of different architectural ideas on that very, very tight site on Exhibition Road. It's a beautiful site because three or four different architects, really important architects, worked with completely different ideas. That's why their buildings are at different levels. That's why their external appearance is also very different. And I wanted the public on Exhibition Road, as they come up from Cromwell Road or from Hyde Park, to glimpse the differences, of course, with a new building that opens itself in a very, very contemporary way. It doesn't mask those differences. Well, it's wonderful and it's beautiful, and in a way it's also irretrievable, because the same people are enjoying walking on Trafalgar Square and those beautiful streets are also carrying, you know, their latest computer and are plugged into a kind of an extension of that world, which is actually not physical but mental and potential. So of course architecture has to contribute to the history, and I, because I love history, because I think history is not at an end, as many architects and other planners think that it's come to an end and you can just go forth. History is a process, and a process whose destiny we have a part in, because we have a role in it, to contribute something, not to just do something on top of it or below it or next to it, but really it's an organic connection. And I do believe that is the connection of history. It's not just the empty word history. It's to know that in that process, we are transforming something, and it better be for the good.
Carrying out conventional town planning, I speak of town, one takes for granted that you're going to work with all sorts of disciplines, with engineers, with landscape architects, economists, and others. And indeed, that way in concert with other skills. That is the traditional or current you talk about designing towns, what you do in terms of collaboration with the other skills would have a lot to offer, both the design and the construction.
No doubt about it, and I want to make that very clear, that architecture from the very beginning, not just city planning, but every building, even a small one, is a collaborative process. It's not a single person. It's not an architect. There's a huge team. There are a huge number of people who are creatively. It's not. I don't just mean executing some instructions. Creative collaboration, which goes all the way to the inhabitants of the spaces, who are also creatively collaborating. So yes, it's a collaborative process. I introduced in Potsdam Platz something that the authorities did not like. I thought that everybody should participate, not only the professional engineers, planners, people who have been trained. I propose that all citizens should have a physical input, not metaphorical and not abstract, but a physical, formal, spatial participation in the project. Everybody who is not professional should be making the city physically. And I proposed that the city should not just be a big forum of debate and discussion, but it should be a huge laboratory, a workshop, where everybody can say, you know, what about this one? What, I like this one. You know, do you think it could not be that way? And I believe this process is available. Of course, planners didn't like it. The city authorities thought that it should only be experts. But I thought everybody. There's a beautiful line from a lecture of Louis Kahn, which I remember. And he said, a great city is a city where an 8-year-old, 7-year-old young child could stand, look around, and said everything could still be different. Everything is still possible in this place. And he said a child is really the ultimate arbiter of the difference of what has been given. So I agree with you. It's a collaborative method. It's a collaborative process. We have to, I think, find ways to involve the public. And I think with new technology, it's more than just opinions. Do I like this building? Do I not like this building? Do I want it white? Do I want it, you know, green? Do I like the entrance here? Do I like classical style? Do I like new style? I think it should really be giving people an access to the creative making of things. And also the reverse. People should take back everything they've given to the city. Take it back, so to speak. I don't mean it even metaphorically. Take all their works, everything that they've produced to give the success to those others, institutions, power groups, and so on. Take it back. It's their own. So I do believe in the populist, really, approach. And I'm trying in Brunnen. We've already, with the investor, produced a kind of a newspaper for the city, newspaper, where people can so not just be informed, but ask to come on, look at the website, put your things into it, and I think it's going to make it much more interesting, and I totally agree with you. It is a completely, it's a work of art of everybody, and also going over time, and I think that's what makes the city such an incredible institution, because only dreams have that capacity, that they are not really just in the present, they're unfolding over time, but they're also intersubjective completely. It's not just one person's dream, because in your dream, you're not it's not your dream, it's the dream's dream.
Don't need to do what people did 100 years ago or even 50 years ago.
Well, It's a very interesting question. I don't know whether I can really answer it, but in my limited experience, because it's limited to the places I've been and I've dealt with, people are very incredible in what the way they think about architecture and space. They are they've been underestimated by the whole history of architecture as sort of users of architecture, you know, and I hate that word. People talk about users, you know, the public is some sort of anonymous, but no, people are really the very core of it. And I think to focus on that desire is really the difference of architecture which is interesting, which is contemporary, versus an architecture which is just a truism or redundancy. And I do believe that wherever I've worked in different countries, in San Francisco, in Denver, or in Berlin, or in Mexico, people come up with much wilder ideas. I often think that, no, this angle is already radical because it's only 22.3 degrees and you cannot really go further. People say, you know, why don't you make it 19 and a half degrees, even narrower, make it more sharp. So yes, I think one does learn a lot, and I don't know where I'm answering you, but certainly in the virtual world, there is so much capacity and possibility, but what I think people really want is to have it also in the real world. It's not just the virtual trip to X or Y and Z. It's actually your car trip to the shop or to see your friends or to have a cup of coffee in the museum, which really is the experience. It's the ultimate sublime experience. It's not the big experience which is generalized into sort of the linear notion of architecture. And I have to say something. And as an architect, I am very aware of the limitations of language, because language is sequential. It develops in lines, and it has a kind of temporality which the city actually denies, because it's simultaneous, and it's globally simultaneous. It's actually all at once, and it's on all dimensions at once. And I think that's the fascinating thing about architecture as opposed to just construction. And I've often thought that, you know, construction is very different for architecture, because construction of a city is only the notion of using homogeneous elements in a repetitive sense, whereas building a city is to fuse together dimensions which are on different planes. They're heterogeneous, they're not homogeneous, and therefore they are not really constructible in that same way. So I think there is a big difference between construction and building. Well, I was lucky enough to work with Heiner Müller, and he was a friend of mine. And of course, one finds friends who are, you know, sort of collaborating on a bigger project, whether they're writers or doctors or scientists or painters, whatever. One has there's a greater body of work being produced than just in architecture and urban planning. And very often, the greatest things in urban planning have been produced in painting. Just think about it. I mean, the greatest city plans were not the ones which were drawn, but the ones which were painted. You know, Piero della Francesca. You know, if you talk about, you know, what a perfect city would have been, or a Raphael. You know, the giving of the keys has the perfect space painted, which has never been realized in architecture. So, yes, it's probably easier to look for architecture elsewhere. Tradition.
Tradition or historical context. And to put these two together, is it like the new era, you know, like after the post-modern
era? No, I don't think they're in contradiction. I think the tradition is not in contradiction to the new. I think history.
No,
it isn't. It really isn't, and I think it depends really on how profoundly one reads that history. But if you read it as a fatality, a history of fatality, then of course it's a fatal history. It's just over. But if you read it as a history of a development over a very long time of a certain notion of humanity, and I agree with you, it's a very slow development. God, it's so slow. If you look at the 50,000 years of recorded history, we don't see such a big change in architecture. Really, we see a huge change in science, we see a huge change in economics, but we don't see, you know, if you compare the oldest human signs of communication, which I guess what I found is the oldest one is a series of holes. There's a big rock, and somebody took another rock and banged it. You know, and there are a number of holes, not holes, kind of indentations. It's supposed to be one of the oldest human things ever discovered. And I was wondering, what did they try to do? You know, they took one rock and they hit another rock with it. But I always thought, you know, they're interesting. They were the first already avant-garde because they were trying to knock at the door and see if somebody's going to answer. And of course, the answer is coming sometimes in a tremendous, you know, look, architecture is, it's a long-range project. We've had only a short time, with 100,000 years.
Okay, I'll take a last one. Couple of questions and then we'll finish. Over there first.
You know, I always use the materials I can afford. No, really, actually. You know, your program and the economy of a building also dictates that you can't use the materials you really want to use. I wanted to use, you know, wood for floors of a building. I couldn't afford it. So, you know, which materials? You know, if I was given gold to do a building, I wouldn't use it, even though it's a great material. It's beautiful. I would use the material that is appropriate to a project. So if you ask me, apartment buildings, I think apartment buildings deserve to be treated the same way that you would treat a beautiful building. They are not any less. We would have to then be, of course, in touch with the logic of industry and what can be made. It's not just a hypothetical question. There are places and things that are sort of a context which are give you also certain options. But sure, one tries to be innovative with materials and tries to use materials that can communicate suddenly something different because they are important in architecture. So a housing block, I wouldn't use, you know, it's interesting. I'm doing something in Israel and it's a new country kind of, and I wanted to use concrete because the early Bauhaus buildings in Israel, which I love, when the pioneers came and they thought this was going to be a utopia, a new world, a new possibility of interchange and connection. But in Tel Aviv, you're no longer allowed to use concrete because they feel that it's been so ugly after, you know, 40 years, 50 years of the countries. They feel that it's a horrible material that the pioneers used. And I've got a problem because I love the pioneering spirit of those settlers, but I see why people don't like the concrete, because it didn't work that well. It's been tarnished by the salt in the sea and so on. So yes, there is a problem, a kind of almost metaphysical problem. So what materials do you use? How do you develop them? And how do you innovate them? At the V&A, we are going to be very innovative. And that has to do also with convincing companies to contribute to research, which is not my job. Nina always twists the hands of these companies. She was able to get us a new form of titanium for the museum in San Francisco for nothing, for free. They donated it. So you need some magic to do good buildings with good materials. I think Norman is a very, very good architect, and he's even a good friend of mine. And you know, I think what is important is that there are different approaches. I think the multiplication of differentials is really the key to an interesting city. It's not to reduce everyone to the same. That's not true of what people really want. It's to give an identity. And I think the more interesting approaches there are, and of course there are very different, very, very, one also finds suddenly a connection between them in the glistening obsessions in Foster's building with a certain kind of aesthetic that refers to ships and industry and airplanes. There is a kind of, I think, sentimental nostalgia which also has a future to it. So no, I'm the last one to say yes, no, this, that. I like those differences, and I think a city with those differences is a rich city, and a city that continues to grow. Otherwise, it would really die at an improper point of its own future.
I think, sadly, we have to draw it to a close here. We've multiplied a lot of differentials in the course of the last hour, and more. There is a reception on the fifth floor, to which I believe everyone's welcome, where we can continue the conversation. But I think that was an exhilarating way to spend the first part of the evening, and so thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Thank you very much.